Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Roger Silverstone. I'm very pleased to welcome you here this evening to the first of a series of debates under the title All Our Futures, Debates on the Arts and Social Sciences. For the past year, Henrietta Moore has chaired a group called the Social Sciences and Arts Think Tank at the LSE. The purpose of this group, which consists of actors and artists and journalists and writers and academics and policymakers, has been to engage in a series of discussions on how to rethink and reformulate the relationship between the arts and the social sciences. These discussions are now being brought out to a wider forum, this is it, and into a series of public debates. One of the aims of the debates as a whole is to explore a space for discussion in which practitioners in the arts could meet academics, as well as individuals from other spheres in the arts and policy advisors. One of the key questions is how the social sciences, with their interest in social policy and social change, might locate themselves in an agenda defined by arts practitioners, and how new ideas might be generated concerning the relationship between the arts and social policy more generally. Government interest in the relationship of arts to social policy is evident in the way it is already planning to use arts initiatives to support projects within health and education action zones. And this evening, our topic is art and innovation and the challenge of new media. It's a focus on new media, the digital world of interactive television, the internet, the World Wide Web. It's a global world, a converging world. Convergence, as many of you know, is a kind of buzzword right now, describing the convergence in industry between industries that have been traditionally separate in telecommunications and broadcasting and computing, describing the convergence between technologies, between video technology and computer technology and telecommunications technology, and describing too the way in which users of these technologies can move seamlessly and effortlessly from one platform to another. But tonight we're focusing on a different kind of convergence, a convergence both between disciplines, perspectives and practices, more precisely the convergence between arts, the arts, and technology and social science, and we're concerned with new technology and new media. There's nothing new, of course, in the convergence between the arts and technology. The arts have always, in one way or another, depended and explored the limits of whatever technology was to hand, and artists have been in the forefront of innovation, not just aesthetically, but also technologically. Marshall McLuhan was consistent in his view and insistent in his view that artists were the first to understand the implications of technological change, and he was thinking perhaps most particularly of James Joyce and Wyndham Lewis. But now we are arguably in a new age, an information age, one indeed which is the focus of much of the teaching and research that we do here at the LSE in our media program. And tonight we're debating the relationship between arts and new media technologies in relation to innovation, in relation to creativity. We're going to ask generally a number of broad questions. We ask about the ways in which new media might change the way in which art is done, art is disseminated, the way art is received. We explore whether new technologies of representation and expression are emerging at the interface between the various arts and new media. And we explore how profound such changes are, or might become, for our capacity to create and understand those things that artists have sought always to create and understand. Is there a new aesthetics in prospect? Well, to discuss these and other questions, let me welcome our four panelists tonight. In alphabetical order, David Doherty, Head of New Services and the Deputy Director of BBC Television and novelist; Anthony Gormley, sculptor and board member of the Arts Council of England; Catherine Clark on my right, an artist partner in MUF, an architecture and art collaboration; and Nina Pope, an artist who recently exhibited at the ICA exhibition Imaginaria. I'm going to ask each of the four to speak for about 10 minutes and maybe come back at each other after the 40 minutes of talk, and then of course we'll open the discussion to the floor and hope for your participation, questions and observations. So let me begin by asking Nina Pope to start.
Hello. I'm going to talk a little bit about the piece which I've just shown at the ICA, which I made in collaboration with Karen Guthrie, the other artist that I normally make work with. We've worked with new technology for quite a while, but we very much see our practice as kind of research through the process of making artwork. So any kind of observations I might have that might be of some value are going to be quite closely tied to talking about the piece of work. So some of you may have seen me over the last month in the ICA at my desk, which is what that slide's of, where I've been with Karen working away on a text-based game, which we've been developing over the last six months, and a model of this game. And this Sunday, the last day of the show, I found myself in the space. It was a kind of average day at the ICA. I'd batted off the third Japanese network film crew who'd been round to look at the show. There was a slightly odd kind of tension in that the Skin 2 festival was also taking place in the ICA that day. So my kind of outfit of a blue and white striped pinny was taking on a slightly bizarre twist that day. And Karen and I were also trying to run a virtual car boot sale on the island to finish off the exhibition. So at this point in the afternoon, I was kind of wondering whether Karen had gone too far with the introduction of a glass eyeball and a wig on her stall. Anyway, as I was kind of... I'll just show... This is Karen working over in her corner. As she's not here, I thought I'd better have a picture of her. As I was debating how to kind of... create a fried food stall for the car boot sale. A particularly bizarre email came in to me. And at the time, I just kind of glanced at it, and I thought, oh, that's odd. I've managed to get a piece of junk mail from somebody who's genuinely campaigning about the sort of politics of a small island. And at the time, I glanced at it, and I assumed that what had happened is they'd done a search on the web for anything to do with islands, and they'd done a mass mail out to people. And I didn't think any more of it. The car boot sale came and went, the show came down, and yesterday I was in my studio and involved in a kind of bout of work avoidance. I was going through the backlog of email from the last month, and I came back to this email. And at the same time I was kind of debating what I was going to talk about today and reading this email, it suddenly came to me in a flash of what at the time I thought was brilliant, that I would use this email as the round which to talk. So this may make sense or not to people, but it began with, "Dear Sirs," which was slightly odd, "I have received this email by mistake, and I assume it's for you, and I'm forwarding it to you." And it continued, "To whom it may concern, we Islanders Against Tourism, IAT, declare our intention to disrupt governmental and other organizations determined to destroy our island in the name of progress. Ecological and cultural destruction thinly disguised as economic progress and tourism. Though some may find our measures extreme, we believe they are necessary to ensure the continued health of our community, free from the extreme ravages of tourism and structured economic development, often to the cost of the indigenous population, in brackets, or ability to afford housing, etc. Current and planned developments are, we believe, having dramatic and irreversible effects on our environment. This must stop, and we intend to ensure your compliance. Therefore, take note that we shall immediately begin covert action with the intent to undermine the image of a cozy community that you are presenting in an attempt to attract visitors to our island, whilst removing or destroying structure servicing this progressive, in inverted commas, activity. We provide this warning purely to save the cost of lives and remind you that the responsibility for ensuring the well-being of the population remains securely in your hands. Current targets, which we will be addressing at random in the near future, include the new rail development. This monstrous wound, severing virtually one side of the island, will be targeted continually until the developers reconstruct the damage caused by this futile and worthless construction. Specific tourist installations. We intend to take action against the caravan park, removing this bruise from the coastline of our island. A development initially allowed by the corrupt activities of former town councillors with undeclared relationships with the developers of this business. Tourist dwellings. Construction on the two holiday homes at the old quarry must be stopped and these structures pulled down. Failure to do so will result in these structures being demolished, with further action to be taken against other holiday homes on the island. IAT is committed to combating activities intended to supply home to foreigners, whilst we, the rightful occupants of this land, are unable to afford land and homes. IAT will also be immediately commencing a campaign against vehicles with foreign number plates. Visitors are requested not to leave valuable combustible items in their vehicles overnight. We demand that governmental bodies of our community consider our demands seriously whilst taking all necessary action to avoid injury and loss of life. IAT demands the immediate suspension of current commercial developments on our island, with the accompanying destruction of our environment, local culture and heritage. IAT via a hacked email account. So obviously when I reread it, I realised it was actually intended for us. And I set about writing a response. Dear Islanders Against Tourism, I am writing in response to your recent communication regarding island developments, copied below. I have taken the liberty of copying this correspondence to some of the island's oldest inhabitants, so as to remain within our policy of open and inclusive decision making. For your interest, these include Javelin, founder member of the Island Development Trust and joint owner of the Crazy Golf Course. Myself, founder member of the Island Development Trust and the person who runs the Island Reading Room. Karen Guthrie, founder member again and joint owner of the Crazy Golf Course. Neil, the pet shop owner. Dr. Knit, the wool and knitting shop owner. Tim, the tablock dweller and developer of the Island radio station. Gavin, who has lived in the caravan park since its inception, which I will return to later. Johnny Morris, the Polar Parade mini zoo developer. Barney, the sports store owner, Lisa, the archaeologist, and Adam, who runs the Lock Protection Trust. Your letter obviously suggests that you have deep concerns regarding recent developments within our community. I will attempt to address some of these below, but I would ask you to further post these onto the Island Bulletin Board, use the command plus BB read, and further to perhaps call a meeting of the islanders to discuss these concerns. The reading room has in the past proved very useful for these kind of meetings, and the car boot sale planning committee found it invaluable. To return to some of your specific concerns, we are well aware that, and I quote, the responsibility for ensuring the well-being of the population remains securely in our hands, and this is a constant source of worry to us. As with any small island, you're correct, we rely for survival on treading a fine line between encouraging tourism, welcoming visitors, and yet not allowing their presence to intrude on the daily life of the inhabitants. If you feel this balance has been disrupted, we can only apologise and request that you give us further guidance as to how you might see this situation being rectified. However, I must address some factual points in the specific targets you address. The new rail development, construction work on the line is now virtually complete, and it's hoped that this line will not only provide a scenic route across the island, but also an invaluable high-speed link for all inhabitants travelling between the east and west communities. Specific tourist installations. I must bring to your attention the fact that some island inhabitants who can in no way be regarded as tourists inhabit this part of the island, and to our knowledge have never raised concern about sharing this with tourists. Tourist dwellings. These are not tourist dwellings. The new development was started as a direct response to the need for more permanent housing for the actual island inhabitants. We are sorry if there's been some confusion over this issue, and we will seek to address this with clearer signage near the site. In your letter, you do not mention the unearthing of the Bronze Age burial site or the Polar Parade development. And we would, of course, be interested in getting your feedback on these issues. Very best wishes, Nina and Karen. So, I thought I'd kind of read that out. It was a genuine email I received. The person who sent it may well be sitting in this room. I have no idea who they were. And in many ways, the kind of oddness of it makes me think about some of the things which I think are most interesting about working with new technology, and which often rely on very low-tech things such as email. This project that I've been showing slides of has been something we've been developing over 2 years now, and it follows themes common to our practice to do with new technology in that it has a very specific concern with audience and who the audience is for the work. So, as illustrated by that letter, one audience for one part of the work is incredibly specific, and I can, you know, I know who most of the people within it are by name, and they're all people who are pretty au fait with technology and probably have played text-based games before, which is where a large part of the work takes place. Purely text in a kind of hidden part of the internet that most people are unaware of. And yet, it's a part of the internet which we decided very actively we wanted to make a piece of work for that particular audience. And then there is another audience for the work who might be people who come into the gallery, might be people who just hear about the work, people who view it in a much more distant way. And I think that's represented by perhaps the person who sent the email. And to me, it just kind of brings up the fact that there's an interest in many different levels of audience for this work, but that as a person trying to produce things in that area, you need to be aware of who you are directing the piece at and where the kind of interest for it is situated. I think I'll stop there, actually.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll go straight on. Can I ask Anthony Gormley to speak, please?
I've come here really with questions. I've responded to Roger's in a way announcement that we're all standing at the threshold of this digital revolution that seems to be coming closer and closer, in which convergence of, in a way, the passive TV viewing of the past is going to be replaced by something more active, interactive, and therefore potentially creative, and where in some way the possibilities of this space, which previously has been articulated by, in a way, the interests of a few specialist companies, becomes available to all of us as producer consumers. I'm interested in that space as, in a way, a huge explosion of public space that we can all occupy. I'm also interested in that space as a space between the imagination and the studio, in which things that could not be built in any other place can arise. And that's something that I'm particularly interested in my own work. The project that I'm involved in now for the millennium, it's called Quantum Cloud. And the challenge for me was to make a structure that has never been seen before, simply by the fact that it arises in this virtual space, digitally articulated. It comes out of a random matrix generator that is now being built, but is not, as was The Angel of the North that you may know of, made by reverse engineering. In other words, it wasn't built from having a model which was then analyzed, digitalized, scanned, and then built again in a different scale. Quantum Cloud is a project to make a structure with about 4,000 elements in which the connectivity could only have been reached. This domain of random matrix connections could only have been reached by the use of digital technology. And this is personally an extraordinary experience for me, to be making an object about which I know a lot of information, but the information is entirely derived from this, in a way, virtual realm. And for the first time yesterday I visited the site, and it was a sort of miracle, because the change from a rotating VRML or DXF file on my computer screen and actually climbing up a very steep ramp onto this platform out on the middle of the Thames, 40 feet above the water, in which I was faced with this very complex structure. It's made out of 70 by 70 steel members that are 144 centimeters long, but all of those members rotate. There are no orthogonal junctions anywhere in the structure. And what interests me about that process is that this is an example of something rather like Nina's work, which has come out of the digital world, the virtual world. Now, what I'm concerned about in terms of the, in a way, the moral and the social implications of the virtual world, is that in some senses, while it is an explosion of public space, the ticket that you pay in order to get into it is isolation and the abandonment of direct, first-hand physical experience. And what I'm very keen to do is use this new tool, which I think has supreme creative potential, to engender things that could not be engendered through any other matrix or placenta, if you like, but to bring them back into the physical world. Because I think that there are severe dangers. I'm afraid I was working till four this morning with somebody who lives a lot of his time in the virtual world. He's Dr. Jeff Pace, who works for Finite Element Analysis, who is the digital company who's helping me realize Quantum Cloud. There's no question. I mean, he's put in 100 hours of coding in the last 3 months, and he looks like a zombie. I mean, the fact is that he has been absorbed by this world, and I think that there is this danger, I think, within the world, the virtual world. While we have the promise of interactivity and, in a way, knowledge of a wide range of maybe inaccessible things, we are also in some way drained of vitality by entering into it. We are sucked into that world. And I'm very, very keen, anyway, to kind of go in there, do something that originate things that can only be originated within that matrix, and then pull them out. There are a lot of other things that I want to talk about, but I think we can do that later. I'm also very, very keen in my role at the Arts Council to evolve a range of arts online portals and possibilities. That means to do with information, to do with putting this technology to use creatively for artists and public alike, and also, I hope, being in some way a arts exchange, making spaces within a new zone of interactivity where works can be shown, commented on, interacted with. Anyway, I think that's enough.
Right, thank you very much indeed. Catherine.
Thank you. I'd like to talk slightly to tangent, I think, to how Nina and Anthony have talked about new technology. So I'd like to talk about one of the issues, and again it's more of a question of yours was, that comes up in my practice, which is the relationship between... To talk about the relationship that exists when one's commissioned to make art in the public realm, the relationship between the artist, the commissioning body, when the commissioning body is a local authority, and the potential audience of that work. Because I think there's a gap that exists between all of those parties in that relationship. Within a brief that one gets as an artist in to make that kind of work, there's often an implicit assumption that that artwork will have a function of some kind. It's never overtly stated, but there's a sense that somehow the world will be a better place for having whatever you're going to do in it. And I think that that's an interesting issue, that the terms within which that kind of artwork is critically assessed, those terms remain different from the terms that I think artists use to talk about their work, perhaps in other realms like the gallery situation. And I think there's also a peculiar relationship then between a confusion between art and design. And I work in collaboration with architects, and one of the sort of edgy dynamics I think that has kept our practice together and made it exciting to work with them is precisely that relationship between use value. And with a practice like architecture or design, use value is very easy to ascribe. I mean, architecture can effectively keep the rain out better than other kinds of practices, and you can evaluate that. But when one starts to think about the use value of art, it becomes much more difficult to ascribe what that can be. And I think in the conversations that I've had within our practice, one of the things that I think that art can do is actually make a space within the public realm for thought to happen, for things that perhaps would remain unthought because somehow they seem to be not relevant or kind of outside of the exchange that normally takes place in public space. And just sort of segue here to make a description of how I kind of understand the kind of pleasure of public space. The architect and writer Catherine Schonfield describes public space as the kind of the living space of democracy. It's the space that we inhabit where our definition or our status, if you like, is sufficiently undefined to allow us to engage in the kind of momentary pleasures of being citizens in an exchange with one another. And so I think as an artist working in the public realm, one of the things that I do find exciting is how one can actually kind of sort of bring into currency almost an understanding that people's sort of most weird and secret thoughts are socially relevant precisely because they are citizens sharing in the shared space, and so those thoughts themselves are relevant. But that's a really difficult thing to start to try sort of to evaluate or to start to give a kind of the outcomes that are necessary, or to describe what the outcomes of a piece of work that aims to do that is to the person who's commissioning you. And then the third element within that relationship is your potential audience. And I think one of the things that is consistently, one of the things that we consistently try to do, I think, within MUF, within our practice, is to make work that somehow engenders that space for conversation, engenders that space for kind of potential thought, without actually pre-describing it as art itself. And so what we try to do is actually make mechanisms for conversations, for exchanges between people, whereby the audience actually does become part of the work and generates the work themselves through the participation in it. And in a sense, I don't think it's important to me whether or not they recognize it as art. I think what's important is they recognize it as an event that values their contribution to it and values their kind of ambition or desires or dreams about who they might want to be in those potential or real spaces that they inhabit. And I'd just like to show a very short piece of video that came from a project that we've recently completed in Walsall, which aimed to make relationships between an elderly population and a young population, and the sort of factor or the kind of context within which we started to try and make these relationships was the kind of shared discussion of romance, of love, of how people first fell in love. And what was exciting about that project is actually we, at a People's Festival, we set up a tent where we actually made the infrastructure for people to talk about the kind of most intimate events in their lives. And this piece of video is from that event.
Should be.
Happened 1984.
We've got.
So I was 16.
Sound but no picture.
And I just left school. And the girl in question, her name is Rebecca Palmer. She works for Channel 4 now. She's an assistant editor. I don't know what she's doing, I don't know who she's seeing, I don't know what's happening. Anyway, what happens is we go out on a date, we're walking around town, and everything's going well, I'm making her laugh. I get back to a father's house, and he was a geography teacher, smoked roll-ups, had a very sort of like musky kind of smell about it, but that's immaterial. So we go up to a bedroom, and then he says he's going out to get some chips. So he says, we put in an order. And anyway, as soon as the door slams, the mood changes. And before I know it, I'm seeing naked breasts for the first time. And then she lies back in the bed, and she was just so adamant about it. This was it. She said, I think I told her in passing that I hadn't lost my cherry. So I hadn't even unbuttoned my Crombie. And I had my trousers around my ankles, and then first time I'd seen sort of like female genitalia, and it was all too much for me. Anyway, pardon?
Did you faint?
I think I drooled. I think copiously, uncontrollably. And anyway, we assumed the position, and obviously to drown out the loud sort of like violent love-making noises, she leans over and she starts to press the record player. We're talking good old-fashioned vinyl now, sort of like so. And then the stylus just hit the record, and I thought it was going to be something like Sexual Healing by sort of like Marvin Gaye. So as I entered her, it started playing Bat Out of Hell. So Bat Out of Hell starts. I don't last the piano intro. I'm lighting up as she's getting relaxed. And then to top it off, her father shouted from the bottom of the stairs, "Get them while they're hot." And then I had to go downstairs and have a conversation with him after his quite sort of like nymphomaniac type daughter had sort of like just deflowered.
And that was about one of almost a dozen sort of confessions from young men about their romantic experiences. And what was so, I think for me, so exciting about that was that as the artists, what we simply provided was like an infrastructure for these people to actually make the work themselves and to generate the audience themselves, which was their peer group and their other friends who were at this festival at the same time. And then from the relationships we made at that event, we then went on to organise, one of the people we met there played in a kazoo band, and we then went on to organise a tea party with the elderly people who we'd been previously made relationships with in Warsaw, and the kazoo band came and did a performance at the old people's home, and we then went on to make video portraits of all of those people that became part of another work that finished just about a week ago. But I think that the reason for showing that work and for talking about this issue is this idea of, as an artist, there are many different ways to work, but I think one of the ways that we've chosen to work is through this process of making relationships with those people who come to be our audience. And one of the, I suppose, difficulties in working in that fashion within the public realm is that one is constantly asked when one is applying for commissions, what's it going to be? And although many briefs now will hold a kind of coda that says, you know, the process of developing this project will be through consultation with the people who live there, and their thoughts and ideas will be input into the final object, which will be a stainless steel arch 4 meters high. And I think that one of the things that I'm most interested in trying to do through the practice that we have is actually changing that culture of expectation that art in the public realm is about making objects and that the object is important rather than the relationships that might generate that object through finding out what is relevant to that place where you put it.
Thank you very much. David.
I thought that was a really good piece of telly. I think we should commission it. Get on. So Karen might be a bit pissed off.
I know, she's going to be in the audience one day.
It's nice to be back at the LSE. I spent 4 happy years here in the mid-80s. Very impressed by the refurbishment, but knew I was home when I went to the loo, and still smelt as if four dead professors had been buried underneath it. You can always tell a place by its loos. The way we are thinking about digital and the internet is, just to give you by way of background, we think it's going to go in about three phases. Now, we don't know how long each phase will be, and we don't know how, but we kind of feel that the journey towards total digital and total internet is will take 10, 15, 20 years. And we're trying to get ready in each phase to carry on delivering the public service. Now, phase one is the one that we've gone into, where it's still very much linear TV based, but there's a lot more of it. I mean, Sky, I don't know if any of you have it, is got hundreds of linear TV channels on it. As you know, all of you know, because you're probably all internet users, that the web is incredibly slow still, and very much text based, although audio is beginning to become a feature of it, but it's still pretty slow and text based. And most of the boxes that are out there are pretty dumb. I mean, they don't do very much. It's hard enough to get to a program. They're not out there setting your kettle. That's phase one. Now, that's the one that everyone's pouring money into at the moment. And, Sky and On Digital, cable, are struggling to deliver that. Now, that's probably quite a short-lived phase because everyone's beginning to bet the house on phase two, which is the world of interactivity. Now, the commercial guys, of course, don't really care about interactivity per se. They care about e-commerce and they care about flogging stuff. But off the back of that, they're creating audio-visual internet and audio-visual interactivity. And that actually is a more interesting place for us as broadcasters to be. Because not only will we have linear TV, we'll have non-linear TV delivered on demand to you for whatever you want. The boxes that are going to come into the market will have a lot of storage in them. There's one on the market now called the TiVo box, which already has 10 hours of storage, so you'll never have to set your video recorder again. And within 3 or 4 years, it's going to have hundreds of hours of storage, which completely transforms what the experience will be for you as a consumer. Now, that's here, actually. I mean, you can those with a fast ADSL connection on their PC can get that, but it's a very, very small number of people with access to it at the moment. But that will grow, we think, probably 20-30% of the population over the next eight years will be in that kind of world. And then there's a final world of complete on-demand digital, where all homes will be digital. Now, that could be 15 to 20 years from now. Well, the internet has moved from being a text-based world to being an audiovisual rich world where on demand is the norm rather than the exception. And how do we prepare ourselves for that has been our preoccupying question, because if you believe that the BBC is an important cultural institution, we can't leave it locked into the world before phase one, in the analog TV world, the analog radio world. And we want to get into this world committed to the same values that we want to inform, educate, and entertain, and we want to be engaged in the relentless pursuit of excellence. And how we do that, and how we organize ourselves to do that, how we create our culture to do that, is again a preoccupying issue for us. But specifically on the arts, I mean, the BBC has, of course, been synonymous in many ways with analog linear arts. Anything from the proms, where we create the event as well as cover it, through to the production of Gormenghast, which we're doing next year, which Graham Greene said was impossible to adapt. And we paid a lot of money to prove Graham wrong. In terms of art and technology, believe me, is fantastic. It's absolutely cutting-edge computer graphic art that's at the service of linear media, and it looks just brilliant. That's just a plug. We've got a link up with the Opera House. We'll be delivering a lot more live opera interestingly, of course, as a mass market broadcaster, that's a bit of a push, because opera will get you sort of 400,000 or 500,000 viewers. But when you think about it, 500,000 viewers to an opera, how many years would it take to fill the Opera House to get 500,000 viewers? So it's still a huge public service. But we know that that world of
of high-profile, high-cost analog arts coverage that helps us to educate and helps us to engage in the work of patronage and celebration will not be enough in the next era, the one that I've just described of on-demand and interactivity. And indeed, what I think on-demand and interactivity will add that the current setup doesn't is it will move away from the tyranny of the linear. Linear broadcasting is in the hands of producers and broadcasters, and it's a very expensive game to get into. It's pretty much non-participatory. And what we're realizing pretty fast is what the internet does is create a participation space where people can engage with us, not just talking back via email, but actually engage in the creation of the product. When I tell you that one of the things we're doing on our Millennium website is we're going to open a garden where anyone can go in and plant a plant of their choice, and that plant has an ecosystem that will grow and develop on its own. So anybody who goes in and plants an oak tree will kill all the plants underneath it. You know, it's got an evolving space, and anybody can choose to get into that space. And that, for me, that is a form of participatory media, which we as a broadcaster could never possibly have done before. So what we're looking to do is to open up participation as well as engaging in patronage. And what it does, I think, crucially for me, is it opens up the idea of arts education in a very profound way. We're doing the Renaissance, a multi-part series on it, this year. Now, in the past, it would have had one outing if you were lucky. One outing, you would have been lucky. And then if you were lucky, you'd have had a repeat. You know, that would have been it. That's you know, the sum total of your engagement with art, with this piece of art from the BBC. In this new world, on linear television, we're going to offer it many times more. So it'll be a near video on demand offer. You'll be able to watch it, not exactly when you want, but we'll be able to offer it many, many more times. But that's only the beginning of it. We can unbundle it, all the research on our website, so you can see, I mean, the amount of stuff that we leave in the cutting room floor would fill a normal, you know, broadcaster schedule for 10 weeks. The amount of research that we leave in trays and in the trash would keep a PhD student going for 10 years. And all that stuff were going to be made available through the new media, on the web in particular. What it also allows us to do is to create interactive versions of the Renaissance. So if you're only interested in one thing, say the Florence, mm-hmm. and that's the journey that you want to take, then we will give you access to that in an interactive way. So instead of having to flip back and forward, as we have told you in the linear world that you have to do it, you'll be able to take your own journey through our interactive version of it. And if you want to carry on, we'll say if you want to do courses in it, this is where you can do courses in it. If you want to help your kids learn about it, you can customize it for them. Teletubbies does the Renaissance. What it does is take... it allows us to carry on being, I think, what the BBC has historically been good at, which is the construction of linear experience, and move into a more profound engagement with our audiences and let them engage with us in more profound ways. But the thing I would say to you is that this new space that's opening up is already being gobbled up by money. The web is... started, as you know, by scientists, pursued by pornographers, developed through email communities, but the amount of money that's pouring into internet development from Microsoft, from BSkyB, from Time Warner, they're trying to lock up that space just as they've locked up other spaces. Those of us committed to public culture and to the public celebration of art, to the public engagement with art, are going to have to fight for money in this space as much as any other. My worry sometimes when we talk about this emerging world is that people think it's a cornucopia of a democratic cornucopia. We're going to have money to engage in it because it's bloody expensive, as you will testify, to make high quality products in here. Anthony's case about 100 hours of coding. Believe me, the interactive Renaissance takes thousands of hours of coding. So the one plea I'd make to you is let's make sure that people who distribute money in our systems are as aware of the needs of culture in this space as much as any other.
Thank you very much, David. Would any of you on the panel like to raise any points in relation to what you've heard before I throw it open to the floor? Then I throw it open to the floor. Are there any questions or observations that people in the audience would like to make? And you are now invited to become performers and artists, clearly, in the terms of the debate.
I'll go on.
Come on. Right. Is there a microphone?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Oh, good. I wanted to address a quick question to Nina about the degree of participation in your project, with basically moving from a sort of text-based game where people send you emails and chat with you on the internet into turning it into a kind of three-dimensional model. I mean, how do you see that process working? Because we've talked a lot about participation, democratic access, opening up of space, and so on. But how did that process actually work, from people writing in text to, was it you and Karen who created that kind of three-dimensional realization? Or was there any sense in which the text people were themselves working in was already three-dimensional? Or were they imagining it as three-dimensional?
As I was saying, the audience for the two bits was completely separate, really. We knew that the audience for the text-based game was going to be very specific and was going to require a very high level of engagement from the people involved in it. So it wasn't a question of them sending in requests. They actually had to code their own buildings. So in order to do that, required a very high level of interactive commitment. I don't like using that word, but... and then we knew the people who came to see the piece in the gallery would be taking away, hopefully, a very different experience from it. You know, they were meant to, they were meant to think about it for themselves, but the piece in the gallery was meant to kind of touch on other issues, really. It was supposed to sort of hint at the perhaps parallels you can draw between the obsessive craft-like activity of making a model railway and the obsessive craft-like activity of coding or creating something on the internet, and kind of draw a parallel between the communities. But so it was a different level of engagement for different people, and that was very specific and very much intended.
Mark, can I? Yes.
It's a question for David Doherty. You talked about the likes of Microsoft and Time Warner as locking up public spaces in other media, other areas, and they're going to go on and do the same in cyberspace. But to what why would you say that they have taken away something that would have been there otherwise? It sounds as though you're saying that, you know, they're denying us something by their activity.
What they'll deny is what you learn about this world is, rather sadly, but that's life, is that marketing and navigation are central to getting people to things. Something like Yahoo, which everybody assumes covers the whole web, only covers about 19 or 20% of the web. Getting onto the search engines is itself increasingly going to be a commercial activity. And as the web becomes commercialized, things that people are giving you for free today, they'll want you to pay for tomorrow. I mean, my screensaver at the moment is El Greco's Scourging of the Money Changers from the Temple, which I just purloined off a national gallery website. Now, I'm not going to be able to do that in 3 or 4 years' time, because people when they can crack a way of paying, of making us pay for stuff that we currently get for free, they'll do it, and that's what they're trying to get into. So it's not they're going to deny stuff; it's going to be bloody difficult for artists to get to an audience. Information that they're there. I mean, what the web, which was great at, and you see it with the Blair Witch Project, for example, which is creating its own space, its own reality, it's going to be really difficult for people to do that, to get out to a bigger audience.
But we pay for what the BBC gives us. You're saying that, you know, it should be free access, but we pay a license fee, which is funding what you're putting out on in terms of multimedia and the internet, isn't it? And it will continue to do so. So that free is not really, it's just different ways of funding it.
Well, there's a difference between, that's why I said, I made my point about commercial, about public funding. Nothing's free. I mean, you either pay for it through your taxes, or you pay for it through a license fee, or you pay for it through your advertising, or you pay for it through your purchases. Everything, you buy everything. But we have historically taken the view that that the creation of culture deserves public funding, and the free-to-air aspect of public funding makes that possible. Now, you say that you pay a license fee. That is undoubtedly true. Of course, we can't stop you currently from consuming the BBC if you don't pay a license fee, so it's still free-to-air. What the license fee does is it an extraordinary marginal cost to each consumer, you know, something like 3p a day, is give you access to masses of material, which at the point of use will be free to you. So you won't have to pay £1 or £2 or whatever. You know, it will be free at the point of use. So I would say that in this space, as much as any other, those who disperse public funding should be thinking about how they create culture and art in the cyber world as much as they think about it in the physical world. That's the point I was trying to make. Now, I think the license fee is a good way of doing that. For us, we spend £22 million on our website, which is nothing on a license fee of 2.2, but by God, it makes a difference in the internet space.
Can I just make one more point? I don't want to monopolize too much, but this idea of as soon as they work out a way of making us pay for it, they will make us pay for it. Encyclopedia Britannica have just given up and decided that they're going to make the entire contents of the Encyclopedia Britannica free on the internet, yeah. And they're hoping to attract advertising. Yeah. So, I mean, that tide is so strong in terms of free access. How is it going to get turned?
They, in the end, they can't afford to keep doing that. In the end, that eats their own business. They won't get enough advertising.
But they can't afford to make us pay for the encyclopedia. No, nobody wants to buy it.
They can't. They haven't worked out how to do it. That's why I made the point. Where, as I explicitly said, when they can do it, they will do it. They can't do it. They can't do it at the moment. But things will emerge. Whether it's through, I mean, Dixon's went to FreeServe, and you know, and suddenly we all had free internet access. But they can't make that pay. The web is still the Wild West economically, as you all know. But at some point, because that's the way capitalism works, they'll work out how to make it work, and then we'll pay. Now, I hope I'm wrong, because actually it's rather fun watching them struggle. But I feel this in my water somewhere, that they'll work out mechanisms for payment that won't be advertising-based. And even if they are advertising-based, that remains a problem, because, you know, what's media? Sorry, I'm hogging this. Media is about, advertising-based media is about selling punters to advertisers, and they only sell what advertisers want. So that equally remains a problem.
There's a question here, and then there.
This kind of picks up a little bit, directly from what you've been saying, and I just wondered what you thought about the open source, what you all think about the open source movement, which, if anybody knows about it, they might know about it in the context of Linux, which is an operating system which is actually entirely free, and to the extent that which this may be transferable to internet business models, internet delivery of content models, where it's suggested that it's a way of actually making free software affordable. That's one of the phrases. It's an entirely different way of looking at delivery. And one of the interesting things that it does, and it picks up on some of the things that Catherine and Nina was saying, is about it can refocus people's attention on the process over the product. So I wondered if anybody had any comments on it.
I don't really know enough about what you're talking about to comment specifically, but perhaps related to that, I wanted to pick up on something that Catherine was saying about a kind of open process and intimacy via technology, which I think is perhaps something that's missing in a more traditional broadcaster's approach to new technology. I agree with lots of your points about the way that the web is changing, etc., but I think you know, if it's not going to go in that direction, now is the time to pick up on things which have been pointed to by projects, perhaps by artists or whatever, I don't know. But the developments you're talking about in many ways pick up on things which, to me, I saw happening about 4 years ago in fine art projects to do on the web, such as Technosphere, where, I don't know if you're familiar with that project, but I think now art, which is being made with new technologies, moving somewhere different from that and more towards a completely different approach to enabling people to participate in projects. And maybe people like the BBC are not going to be in a position or capable of following that kind of line of inquiry, but I don't know. But I actually wondered if you could give more of a definition of what you're referring to, because it might be interesting to bring it into the discussion.
Essentially, it arose out of somebody called Roger Smallwood in 1984, who decided that he, and along with many other people, particularly on the West Coast, centered around California, didn't want people to pay for software. I mean, it was a flat-out radical idea. He didn't see why people should pay for software. And although people like Bill Gates obviously think that's a crazy idea, it actually did take off. They developed a particular kind of copyleft, and the public copyleft thing, a kind of general public license, which allowed people to create things and then transfer them for nothing, as long as the source was made available for what it was, so that people could then take that and then recreate it and then hand that on. And that was something that then was taken up in the early 90s, particularly with this, not just with this operating system, but many other things became possible, such that you could generate participative, I mean almost democratic entities like operating systems, but like many of the things which power the whole web, as some perhaps all of you know, are actually all free. The web server Apache is more than half the world's web servers run on this. Many of the web databases, which are increasingly powering almost and will power almost everything you see other than small home sites, they're nearly all done with open source free software. And so I'm just interested to the extent that they are saying, look, you can have the software for nothing, but you have to pay for the support, which again, once more, I think is not, the product is free, but the process of maintaining it is what you pay for. Mm-hmm. And in point of fact, if you sit down with the books and fill your head with enough of this stuff, you can also make it free, which from my point of view as a cultural and social environmentalist is very exciting, because people who are doing non-profit work, not for profits, can, if they can't afford to pay for the support, they can actually sit down with the books and learn it for themselves. And it does get easier, even though the amount of knowledge is expanding. And I think there are some profound lessons that could be learned in artistic and cultural communities from some of the things that have been coming out of California.
Thank you very much. That's a question just there.
I think the thing that stands out to me from the last hour or so, more than anything else, is the difference between the man on the video, who was hugely entertaining, and we all laughed at, and who I will generally call, the difference between him and what I will generally call the producers. That's what's really striking to me. But that guy still didn't have his finger on the button as far as producing what he was involved in. David, in particular, do you see any potential in the stuff that you're talking about for more democratisation, and I mean along things, I mean that's obviously like class difference, democratisation along class difference, and anything a bit more gutsy?
Well, I'm sorry we weren't very funny. We'll put the jokes in next time. The it's interesting, I do. I mean, we experimented 10 years ago with a thing called Video Nation. Don't know if you've seen any of it, which is very much like that, actually. And it was a pretty cumbersome task in those days, because it was before lightweight cameras, and we had to send, although it was so-called self-operated cameras, it was still pretty much an old-fashioned broadcasting system. We had to get them in with hours of editing, and we had professional editors on it, and we packaged their experience. With the development of DVD cameras and very lightweight cameras, that became completely unnecessary, and actually it became a much clearer voice came out of the Video Nation team. But it's still mediated via broadcasting.
I mean, it's still put out on BBC Two. With the world that you know we're describing in somber terms, that people, the Video Nation experience, can actually happen across the space, as it were, where we can simply hold the rein and allow these voices to communicate with each other. Now, I see that as one way forward. It's quite interesting what you're saying about showing the workings as well. I mean, there's no reason why we can't facilitate that or do that. I mean, historically, it's been our job to hide the wires, you know, so that people don't see the process. And indeed, in our experience, most people aren't that interested in the process. But I do think you make an interesting, valid point that this does allow us to open that up and show people what's actually going on and let them take part in it. So I would say we're at the very edge of understanding what this is all about. I agree with you about that. I think finger on the pulse. It's difficult to find the pulse. We don't know where the patient is. And so what we're moving, I would argue, just a wee bit ahead of the technology at the moment. But we're not that far ahead. We don't yet understand its full benefit. But like the Video Nation example, producers, creators will get there. They will start to exploit the benefits. And I think audiences will stop simply being audiences and start becoming much more participative. Does that answer the question?
If you think there's really that opportunity.
I do, and I genuinely do.
There's one here. Maybe.
There's a microphone coming, Nico. Hold on.
I was quite intrigued about
the very different mindsets on the left and on the right of the panel. It felt to me that on the left there was a sort of a recognition that that in a funny sort of way that work can find its audience through the net, which is very, very different from the idea of sort of broadcasting, which is sort of a push strategy and really I'm sort of switching channels, and that's about as in a linear world as far as you know my choice is concerned. And I wonder whether the BBC, by trying to be all things to all people in this sort of brave new world, is not deluding itself, forgetting that still be a broadcaster and its work could find its way through those new distributed channels. It's just as Sarah's work can find its way through these distributed channels, whether it is at all necessary for the BBC to invest as heavily as it does into internet technology and in this whole thing. There is this argument that there is a dilution of programming content going alongside with this sort of diversification, and I wonder whether it's necessary to do that in order to compete in this new world, or whether there would be a way in competing in this new world without having to be all things to all people.
you talk to any broadcaster in any part of the developed world, and every single one of them in the past 2 years has woken up to the internet. Indeed, to such an extent that some of the people in one of the American broadcasters said that the TV station is simply the front end to the internet. I don't think we're deluding ourselves. I think that the internet and the World Wide Web as two separate entities are going to be crucial to our future. Murdoch, of all people, who was very anti-internet to begin with, as was Gates, don't forget, has just said that BSkyB is now an internet company, and that's where its value is going to come from. And if we stayed out, the BBC would not be here in 15 years' time.
But you still think of yourself as a broadcaster and not as an internet company. That's the crucial difference.
No, we think of ourselves as a cultural creator, you know, and whatever distribution means that are out there, we want to be on them.
Yes. Two things. One, a comment and then a question, yet again for David. Sorry, David. The comment really is about the discussion about the nature of the net and the nature of having to pay for everything. I think it's important to keep the distinction between the community aspects of the web and the distribution aspects of the web and what the web will become as a kind of high-speed network later. Community is enormously important and is growing in an amazingly massive way at the moment. Distribution of products or content is also important, and what you pay for and what you don't pay for is important. I had a great quote the other day that everybody really likes going around to their friends' houses for dinner. That's community, but you pay in a restaurant. I think it's important that the world and the virtual world have those kind of models and parallels. The second thing, the question for David, specifically, BBC's hugely important role in developing art. Contemporary music, without the problems in Britain, is a very different place, yeah. For instance. what's the BBC's policy on actually starting to develop online art? Because looking at your various online expressions, BBC.com through Worldwide is obviously a commercial beast. BBC Online is heavily built around programme brands, and as a producer and consultant working with both of those environments, I know that. Are you looking at partnerships regionally, nationally, with Arts Council, with Arts Boards, to actually start looking at the same kind of cultural support for people working in art in the online space?
Well, just being here makes me realise that that's a very good question. I was just listening to the other panellists who should speak. I mean, it makes me think that that's what I'm going to go back and talk about. I mean, we are moving away from programme-based sites to category-based sites, and BBC Art will be one of those sites, and still BBC Art, of course. And how that evolves, I think, so that people can make art on the internet from the with the BBC's engagement, I think it's a very interesting question.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just come in on David's reply there, I mean, I think it's very important that that the BBC and the Arts Council do get together to actually work out a partnership in which that kind of thing can happen. And I think what we're really talking about is how we find new forms of content, new ways of producing, in which maybe the distinction between those high production values that we might associate with the BBC as a production company and the idea of the internet as a zone of intimate conversations that can also be highly visual and in some way communicate at a different level. I think there's a new ground that is somewhere between those two, which Arts Online, which I'm convinced has to be done in partnership, and it seems that the BBC is certainly the first person that the Arts Council should approach, or the first organisation that the Arts Council should approach as a potential partner.
I just wanted to pick up on something actually that came up in the previous question, but it's sort of relevant to the discussion, which was this idea. And it's peculiar because often in these debates about art, there's suddenly a scratchy moment where this issue of democratized access or democratized participation comes up. And I think there's always this sort of sense as though democracy is a kind of a real sort of thing rather than an idea that we participate in and move towards. It as an idea, not as a real thing that exists, that somehow we're either in it or we're not, we're out of it in some situations. And I think it's really important to acknowledge kind of the processes often that artists work through, that the artist always remains the artist within that situation, and they make the art through the relationships with the people who are participants. They're the audience, they're kind of, you know, many different things in many different situations, but there still is this criteria or this sort of this thing of being an artist.
Yeah, let's say it's being a program maker.
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems to me that there's a difference between the broadcasting side, and things like the BBC Online site, which is the biggest site in Europe in terms of numbers and hits and so on, and judging the success of a medium by its size, and which is related to the amount of money to some extent that you can put into it, and the sort of art that we were hearing about at the beginning, which is much more local and based around much, much smaller communities. And it seemed to me that there's an awful lot of art and a great potential for the new medium, the new interactive medium, to have lots and lots of art experiences of all sorts of kinds going on, which cumulatively add up to a lot of people being involved in the space, but not all the same people at the same time in the same experience, which is on the whole what audience chasing, ratings chasing tends to happen. You judge the success of something by the number of people that watch it. With an arts experience, you can have massive involvement in the arts through the new technologies and at quite low level cost, and that's successful. That's extending and using the new media and involving lots and lots of new and different communities. So I think we shouldn't get too worried, in a sense, about at a local level about the domination of the big money and how they're going to make us pay for everything, although I'm sure that that's a problem. But it doesn't have to be a problem for artists working, or does it have to be a problem for artists working at a local level in the way that you were talking about earlier?
Nina and Catherine, do you feel that there's a problem there?
Well, I mean, for us working within text-based communities, which in essence have remained not completely the same, but very similar since the inception of the web up until now, was a kind of conscious decision in that to move away from the kind of whiz-bang, video-on-demand, interactivity kind of part of the web. But that was only one project that we're working on. I mean, we did another piece just prior to that where we looked very much at webcasting. So I think it's a question of just making a conscious decision about the quality of experience you want to deliver to what kind of scale of audience for each piece, really.
Yeah, I think that's that issue of what kind of relationship you have with your audience, I think, is something that I've become more and more interested in. And in a sense, yeah, the measuring of the audience is not a measure of success of the piece. And I think that in some projects, to engage with people who might not previously have had a or had any interest whatsoever in kind of arts, even if that's only like five people who become your audience through the participation of the making, I think there's a value in that, because that changes what those five people think, and those five people have conversations with, you know, X other people. But I think particularly in the work that we do, we very often work in for local authorities in areas that are getting public money, and the reason they're getting public money is because they're very poor areas, and the kind of people, communities that we often work with, have no access to digital technology at all, or they have a kind of institutionalized access through school, and so that kind of level of creative meandering that one can have between you and your computer just doesn't happen, I think, for a lot of those people.
Anthony, can I bring you in on this? I mean, I may be wrong to suggest that Angel of the North and Quantum Cloud are hardly intimate. This is
well,
work,
I'm very
I'm
struck. I mean, I like the comment from the middle of the floor that we had a kind of sexual divide here, and what was happening on the right of the panel from my position was this realization of the potential intimacy of what web communication offers, and that the activity in its own right is in some way creative and life enhancing. But actually those modes, those modalities of connection are allowing people to reflect upon their own lives in a way that wasn't possible before, in empowering ways. And it seems that what I was proposing in terms of my use seems rather clumsy in relation to the delicacy of those propositions. However, I'm actually terribly excited about, and this is, I mean, what I was talking about was very different from the web, even though I think the web is an extraordinary, both generating space and transmission space. I'm actually just amazed at what is possible in terms of digital processing as a tool itself, and I don't really want to answer Roger's question. Obviously, those two works are in many senses public and totemic, and don't have this scale of intimacy. However, I would like to feel that the success, if one can talk about the success of a project like the Angel of the North, is that it actually has well, I've certainly had an enormous amount of feedback, which is to do with people being quite intimately affected by the existence of this thing that in some way has drawn thoughts and feelings out of themselves about their own lives and how their lives are located in a real and an imaginary landscape, that perhaps its existence wouldn't, you know, without it wouldn't have been possible. And I don't take any personal kind of credit for that. In many ways, the Angel of the North used the web as its connective principle in terms of there being an enormous amount of cross-fertilization between various agencies, so that we had, you know, the geomatic department and the Center for Innovation in Design at Newcastle University engaged with the virtual reality department of Teesside University, two or three different fabricators, and there became we were using ISDN lines to communicate all the CAD programming for the cutting schedules, for example. And even though that's a very mechanistic model, nevertheless, that piece arose out of an extraordinarily complex connectivity, which was very mechanical, admittedly, but was a collective expression that wouldn't have been possible without the use of new technologies.
Okay, we have one question there, two, and three, and then that's going to be it, I think. First question.
Thank you. This question goes to David, and either yourself, you might want to answer it. I know that BBC is proud of giving a universal service to all of its customers, and you offered us a very, very nice alternative future with second generation boxes that will have numerous digital possibilities. But that will probably mean that you will offer numerous digital services as well. Now, I was wondering what happens to the audience that won't be able to buy in to that new technology. And I would like to link it with the difference that it is between the black and white television license fee, which at a lower level than the color one. Will there be another one introduced for those customers or audience that can buy into that digital technology, or something else is going to happen?
Well, it's a question of time scales here. I mean, although people currently don't have access to this technology, the thing I was trying to talk about was the next 15 to 20 years, where it will become, I believe, in the end, universally available as television is. Our problem really is that we could stay doing what we do for the next 15 years and get there and end up with, you know, a reach of 10-15% in an audience share, you know, which is pretty non-existent, because all the digital generations, I mean, something like 50-60% of children more probably are now in multi-channel homes. And the other ones are going to go into digital homes. And if we became an old-fashioned, irrelevant analog broadcaster, we wouldn't be doing anybody any good. So we've taken the decision we have to go in and try and serve each generation of boxes for those people who have chosen to buy them. We're not betting the house on this. I mean, we're constraining our spending to 10% of the license fee on it, and a lot of the content that we make in there can also be backcycled into the OWL networks. Our big ideas are to do with citizenship and culture and education, and we've laid those out to the government. We think it'll cost about £700 million extra a year to deliver this and to keep, I would argue, to keep a public space available in these new worlds. A government committee called the Davis Committee recommended a digital license fee that would be the best way of doing that. Initially, we were ambivalent about that because the flat rate fee has served the BBC well over many decades, and I believe the country well. But we'll come down slightly in the favour of that, saying that if there's to be any new funding mechanism, then a digital licence fee is probably the way forward.
Can I just ask for a brief question, please?
Uh, I have one more question for David and the BBC and the very impressive new BBC portal, especially distributed to schools, the BBC Schools Channel. Are you monitoring your response in the school community, and what sort of response are you getting in terms of their own infrastructure and their ability to take aboard the wonderful curriculum that you're presenting them? Who's actually monitoring the process? Is it successful?
Well, it is good. I mean, we're talking a lot to the government at the moment about how to move forward together on this, because, I mean, they have rather grandly announced that they're going to put PCs in every child's desk, and we'll pay for the infrastructure. I mean, clearly they've got to tell us how they're going to do that. In the meantime, what we've done is gone ahead and developed, as you say, the portal. We are monitoring it. I can't tell you precisely how schools are perceiving it at the moment. But we can talk afterwards, and I'll get you someone to talk to.
I think we better draw a line under what's become a very interesting and wide-ranging discussion. Can I thank David and Nina and Catherine and Anthony for their participation this evening? Can I thank you for your participation? And to pick up what David has just invited you all to do, he's invited you to join him and us for a drink upstairs in the senior common room. You're more than welcome. Just to remind you that the next meeting, the next debate, is on the 24th of November in this room at 5:30, and it's on arts and public policy. Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for the panel.